Hello and welcome to the 18th Century Podcast. My name is David, and this is my co-host, Cal. Cal?
Hello.
Awesome.
Pleased to be here.
We have a great first episode lined up, actually. This is going to be about coffeehouse culture, especially as it started in the 18th century.
Mm. I'm going to talk a bit about the 17th century, too.
Okay.
Push it. It's going to be the long 18th century.
It's always the long 18th century.
It's always
We might even talk about something. Yeah. I was just going to say, we might still talk about something that's relevant today, or happening today, because the 18th century never ends.
Never freaking ends.
But it is interesting you say that, because I was just, before we started this recording, I was just reading something earlier about the 17th century.
Do tell.
So maybe we should start there. But so I'll go first.
Okay.
What I was just finished reading, and what I was showing you a little bit about. So that section, though, was about coffee and medicine.
Oh, okay.
And so one of the first, or at least in this book, by Aiton Ellis, the Penn University, blah, 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 blah.
I love that title, too.
The Penn University. That was almost going to be the name of this podcast.
Yeah, I remember that.
But anyway, so they were one of the early uses of coffee, one of the ways it was introduced from the Islamic world into the Christian world, into specifically the English-speaking world, was as this medicine of sorts. And, get this, what it was treating was alcoholism. So one of the parallels...
That makes sense.
Yeah, one of the parallels that we'll see throughout this thing. Yeah, is it advertises, okay, if you take it first thing in the morning, it's great for it. And you perk up, you don't get the ill effects of alcohol, and you even stop wanting to drink it. And so that leads to sort of these tales of the medicinal and the healing properties of coffee, you know, this strange black liquid that's slightly bitter and maybe a tonic for different things. And so this leads to the quote from Muhammad that I was that I was referencing. They say that after he experienced drinking coffee for the first time, the exhilaration that followed, he said, I felt able to unseat 40 horsemen and to possess 50 women. So obviously, you know, this is a little bit exaggerated, but
maybe.
Well, it's how it made its way into some of the Western world. What is that? What you were reading about for the 17th century stuff?
No, so for the 17th century stuff, I was doing some readings by Brian Corman. He has a whole sort of book length study called "The Social Life of Coffee," which I sort of gleaned before this podcast. But then he has a more sort of focused historical take in an article. Oh, I forget where it was published now. But it was a huge kind of takedown of Jürgen Habermas, which I was not expecting whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It was called Coffeehouse Culture Reconsidered, or Coffeehouses Reconsidered. One of those two. Forgive me.
One of my people also reacted against Habermas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what it was, at least in the more sort of like focused article, historical article, was charting Charles II's sort of attempts to rein in on this huge proliferation of coffee houses in Restoration London. I think you get the first ones around the 1650s?
Yep, 1650 on the dot, 1650 if our sources are to believe. In Oxford.
In Oxford?
Yeah. Oh, wow, kind of opened, cool. Apparently, I don't know how they know this, by a Jewish gentleman named Jacob.
Okay, yeah, I've never seen that.
Okay, yeah. It was part of, like, Cromwell welcoming Jews back into England to settle.
Okay. Well, that's another point, too, that I was going to sort of bring up in relation to Charles II. It was a part of the reason he's so, like, fiercely against this proliferation of coffee houses is the kind of print media that you're seeing being discussed within the coffee houses. He wants to rein in on that as kind of, you know, fake news.
Or so this is Charles II.
News. This is Charles II.
Okay, Restoration.
And when I first read it, I was like, oh, Charles. Like, poor Charles. Poor, silly Charles.
Silly? Wait, what's silly about this?
Because it's such a foolish, like, why? Because, first of all, I really like Charles II.
Yes.
For a lot of reasons. And so
all the people in your class know that.
Yeah, that's true. All of my students certainly know that by this point. bring him up every day.
Well, I mean, Charles actually petitioned successfully to close coffee houses in London.
Right. Yeah.
Went close for a whole 10 days.
Yeah, that's... They didn't last very long. It was always sort of being thwarted, or somebody in Parliament was sort of one step ahead of Charles and making sure that didn't actually happen. Mm-hmm. But I sort of kind of felt bad for Charles II too, if only because, as much as it is a kind of, it's like a very sort of, I'm getting into like topical subject matter here.
That's what we're here for.
With this stuff on fake news. But in all fairness, Charles I was kind of, you know, first regicide, and at least the way I teach it is that was sort of a result of Cromwell exercising a certain kind of control over the kind of printed propaganda that you were seeing circulating outside.
Certainly being more effective at it.
And so of course Charles II is going to remember, he's going to remember his father being murdered at the hands of Cromwell, and sort of how that all came to be. And so, yeah, I don't know. I just thought that was kind of interesting. And so, yeah, he does eventually succeed in, as you mentioned, closing the coffee houses down for, what did you say, a period of 10 days?
Yep, that was in 1675. Days.
And then, as far as I understand, 1675?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, cool. I'm thinking almost even a bit later now. I'm thinking about 18th century coffee houses, I'm talking about restoration coffee houses. I'm sure there's these huge sort of evolutions in how the architecture of those...
Yes.
And the space itself actually worked over a period of, you know, whatever, 100,
yeah, actually, 40, that, 150 this might be a years. good segue into that. So I don't know how much you read about the interior of coffee houses.
I have one cool fact that I want to say, but I'll let you go ahead.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Hopefully I don't preempt your cool fact.
No, go ahead.
But in my mind, I had zero conception. So I knew about coffee houses. I knew, you know, as most of us 18th century scholars knew, okay, they're sites of, you know, social mixing, of socializing, and, you know, business is conducted there, you drink coffee, blah, blah, blah. You learn some things, too. I didn't know how they looked inside.
Yeah.
The only pictures I can picture in my mind are from late 18th century, early 19th century coffee houses, where you have these sort of luxurious-looking lounge chairs and sofas and nice stoneware, I guess. But no, in the first coffee houses, we have on record saying that it's very simple inside. It's a rectangular building, as most buildings are, and there's just a long table with benches on two sides. So it's just one long table.
In the Tories.
It's funny you say that. There were lines drawn between coffee houses, but... layout, very simplistic layout with, you know, one end of the table, then you have the proprietor giving out coffee and serving it to you there. But this one table, zero distinction, in its earliest conception, was designed to sort of facilitate this class mixing, right? There's no better seat. There's no sofas that you can lounge. There's no private corners. You're sitting there with a bunch of other people who are strangers.
As much as, and that was kind of his takedown of Habermas, was that as much as these public sites kind of are remembered as these sort of, I guess, inclusive spaces where anybody can come in and have a voice, there were still a lot of restrictions on who could and could not sort of enter into this sphere.
That is true. That is a common theme amongst the articles.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll say that it wasn't that women were prohibited. It didn't seem like, because we both read the Mall King.
They didn't want to go.
We both read the Mall King.
Yeah, Mall King stuff.
Coffee house, which was this famous coffee house that
synonymous with
the seedier aspects of coffee house culture, whose proprietor was mostly a woman named Mary. But you're right, in England, it was largely male. And here's a hot fact for you. In Germany, some coffee houses went further and just flat out banned women.
Oh, wow.
Right? So while in England, it might have been sort of understood implicitly that this is a male space, the businesses regulated that. And this is the opposite, however, of France. women were more common in coffee houses in France. And there were some coffee houses where it was mostly women.
Nice.
Yep.
The salons, almost?
Yeah, yeah. It was different.
Kind of
yeah.
extension of that.
Yeah, French coffee houses were much more fancy.
Really?
Yeah. There was a...
I mean, I imagine so, but I'm just interesting to hear.
It comes a little bit later to France, but after it comes to France with, I think, the French prototype of the coffee house was in 1686. So full 36 years after it made its way to England.
Okay. I think 1686 is when White's coffee house.
Oh, interesting. We'll get to that. Nice coincidence, yeah. But that one succeeded in France because of good location. And, interestingly, mirrors.
What do you mean?
So the article I was reading was just like, it was situated well, affluent part of town, and it had mirrors. And
like, within the...
Yeah, yeah, inside the building.
Was that a desirable...
I had no idea. But apparently, yes, mirrors were a desirable furniture element to have in your establishment. That was not happening in England.
Yeah, that is really strange. If only because this is a space where you're supposed to be like, God, it's supposed to be like an I and thou relationship that you're having with the person sitting across from you at the table. But instead, it's people reflecting back on themselves. How do I look in here? Yeah, this looks good.
I'm sure the English are getting a kick out of that, right? It fits all those sort of preconceptions about the French. But perhaps historically... This was because the king had just finished building the Hall of Mirrors in Versailles. And it was just this huge hall. It's still there today. It's a huge hall that's just absolutely covered in mirrors. And that was a new attraction in the palace at Versailles. And it's a sign of wealth and royalty. And I guess it became fashionable after the king does it. So if your coffee house has a bunch of mirrors, damn, you're in.
I'm trying to think if any modern places do that. I can't think of any off the top of my head, but it certainly
seems like a fun house mirror.
Not even so dramatic. Just like an entire wall of like a mirror or something, like the top half of a wall devoted to a mirror.
In a coffee house, yeah, that seems rare.
I guess it is kind of rare. Thinking of how Starbucks are laid out. Right?
Maybe half the wall are glass, but then that's see through, and then the other half is like dark gray or dark brown or something.
The one of the things too in the Corman article was that he followed sort of this development. Not just, he doesn't limit himself to restoration coffee houses. He does sort of move into 18th century coffee houses too. And there's this moment where I forget which monarch it was now. Too, apparently William and Mary were both sort of
They're much easier on coffee houses than Charles was.
Much easier on coffee houses, but still sort of interested in, reining in on what could and could not go on there. And so I think it was Charles tried to make an attempt to limit the amount of newsprint that was circulated. Did I say that already? So yeah, Charles's sort of effort was to, he was more concerned with the fake news, that was the false news that was being
discussed at coffee houses.
And of course that failed, as most attempts to censor print did in this period. And I can't remember when this happens now, and that's why I'm kind of circling around it, but there's this point where some bill passes, some kind of new licensing deal happens in London, where you've got people allowed to sell coffee, and you're allowed to have a coffee house, but they're more kind of like, what's the best metaphor here? Like when you go to the mall and there's like a little kind of shop where you can pick up... it's like a coffee stand almost. So they remove the kind of table setting and these sort of like these spaces where people can conglomerate and actually have discussions. And what happens is the coffee house owners and proprietors that were sort of picketing to, let us sell our coffee, let us sell our coffee. We are tradesmen, we are tradesmen. That's exactly sort of all they got away with. For a certain amount of time, was that they were allowed to continue trading coffee and selling coffee, but they weren't, and nobody really listened, I think, was sort of something that Brian mentioned too, is that as much as this was sort of passed in Parliament, nobody really paid any attention to
right.
it.
Right, so they tried to remove mind, the social aspect.
But they tried to remove that wow. social sphere aspect and just have it so, yeah, you can sell coffee and you can buy coffee, but you can't linger around.
No soliciting.
No, yeah. Don't talk to anybody about it.
This is interesting, and before we leave the 17th century completely, or the early part of the long 18th century,
yeah.
I do want to touch on some of the aspects, because that is so hypocritical of Charles and future royals, but not understandable. It's understandable,
mm-hmm.
Because when the coffee house started in the 1650, and it went to London a couple years after that, and then from there went throughout England, they were sites, as they are later on, and even today, sites of sort of social exchange and ideal exchange.
Yeah.
Not necessarily to the benefit of the Cromwell regime.
Interesting.
Yeah. So one of the, you know, coffee houses, it should be said, were this bastion of freedom of speech in an era where that was difficult to achieve
mm-hmm.
In print and stuff like that. And large-scale sort of information dispersal was hard. And so you can rely on these businesses, these coffee houses, as sort of reliable places that you can walk into, learn the news, read the latest pamphlets, you know, whatever small pieces of literature, and then discuss political ideas without the fear of retribution.
Yeah.
Right? They're this natural place where people can gather without it being super suspicious. And so, naturally, they're going to be anti-establishment to some extent. And it's hypocritical.
An establishment of anti-establishment.
Yes. And so that's why the royal side is a bit hypocritical, because it started yeah. off as a base where fellow royalists during the Civil War, during Cromwell's regime, can gather and talk about how they hate Cromwell yeah. and plan ways to usurp him.
This guy's an idiot, too.
Yeah. And so, and it's understandable, because after the Restoration, after the royals come back in power, the coffee houses have not changed in their function. They're still anti-establishment. It's just that the establishment has changed,
yeah.
and now you're the establishment. And you know firsthand, because you are doing it, that these coffee houses can be seedy places of dissension.
It's a metaphor for life itself.
Yeah. So then you try to regulate it, and you're like, wait, I got power through this way, but I don't want anyone else to be able to do this. So you have that, and one of the ways that after the Restoration, they tried to discredit through their own propaganda. You know, they learned the value and power of propaganda from Cromwell, I guess.
Yeah.
But they tried to disseminate propaganda against coffee. And one of the ways they tried to do that was they praised ale instead.
Oh, okay.
Right? So ale and taverns and inns had been a long-standing English tradition before this.
And so, yeah. And so I'm wondering to what extent, too, it's just these owners of these kind of the ale houses.
Oh, probably,
wanted
yeah.
to be these people are encroaching on our business.
Yeah.
This rage for these hot drinks is kind of taking away our gin sales and our beer sales.
It starts off during Cromwell's reign, because Puritans did like it. You know, obviously Puritans like anything that sort of sobers you up. Right? but they like it both for the space to discuss ideas and its effects against countering alcohol. And you have a famous mm-hmm. coffee house like the Turk's Head with members like Milton and Pepys.
Oh, cool. Of course you know which coffee house Milton
is. Yeah, I'm a huge Milton fan. But the royalists afterwards praised ale and other alcohol for making people submissive and tranquil.
Yeah.
And it's understandable as well, because, you know, you just had a 20-year civil war. You kind of do want some semblance of, okay, let's calm down, guys, drink some alcohol, and let's not think too deeply about the politics of things. Because the last time we did that, we killed our king.
That was one thing I was thinking about sort of heavily in just thinking of critiques of Howard Mass's conception of the public sphere.
Interesting you bring that up, because that's one of the ways that propagandists try to discredit, again, coffee houses.
Oh, do you tell?
Was that they're these sites of gossip instead of
science,
you know,
of gossip,
political discussion, which I'm sure they were equal parts gossip and political discussion and whatever else you can think, right? And this leads to this suspicion that it somehow makes the coffeehouse goers, primarily men, more effeminate because they're gossiping all the time.
There's the rub.
And in 16, this leads to like a culminating point in 1674, the women's petition against coffee. So this small-scale riot by women, supposedly, publishing this pamphlet, alleging that the coffee houses were taking away their men. both in the sense of like they're making the men impotent and more effeminate through the gossip, and just like their presence is gone from the home because they're in the coffee house so goddamn much.
Yeah.
But also, it's interesting because it shows the sort of sentimentality and ethos of that era, because it one of the ways it tries to critique coffee houses is the suggestion that it's a foreign, like, suspicious thing. It's a foreign Muslim drink. That's possibly deliberately.
And the French are good at it too.
Yeah.
On top of that.
It's black, they say. It's a drug, which, it's true. And it encourages, for somehow, sloth and indolence. I guess that's because you just sit there and do nothing when you're talking, instead of maybe the industry that they wanted to see, where in like you're,
you know, should be producing.
They should be, yeah. And so, interesting quote from that pamphlet that the women say, if you go to a coffee house and you're a man, you run the hazard of being cuckolded by dodos. Now, there's some like there's some suspicion that it wasn't women who wrote this pamphlet, and that it was just a satirical idea of what women might say about the frequent coffee house going. Mm-hmm. But it does show us sort of the ways that people then were possibly against coffee houses, right? That it's foreign, it has, you know, unknown drug side effects, it seems to make you somewhat effeminate. Like, we laugh because we can see, oh, there's some possible kernel of truth to saying, oh, gossip is not exactly a very masculine thing to do in the 18th century.
Which I think really is just this kind of like the libertine tradition, really. You're getting these kind of rakish guys that don't really belong to the aristocracy,
mm-hmm.
but the more middling trading sorts, the Daniel Defoes and the Henry Fieldings of 18th century London.
Defoe was a rake.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
But you're right. And this idea of a rake or libertine being in the coffee houses, I think, starts earlier than you would think, and earlier than I think a lot of people would think. It's not, I would even say it's less a facet of later coffee houses than it is a facet of those early coffee houses.
Okay.
Right? Because from the article that we both kind of familiar with, the Mall King article, and both of these articles by Helen Berry and Lawrence Klein are talking about sort of these early coffee houses before the unspoken rules of conduct were established, they were much more lawless, right? And you have hand in hand with the social mixing of these rakes who possibly there for prostitutes, lower class people just in there to get a chance to talk to people or enjoy a drink or, you know, relax, and also some aristocrats, right?
Yeah.
And so with this mixing, you have a bit of chaos. And it's not as rowdy and violent as the taverns and inns due to alcohol, you do still have heated discussions, arguments, and debates. It wasn't all as orderly as the Turk's Head, the Milton coffee house, where Pepys tells us that they had structured debates and cast ballots at the end to determine the winner. That one, apparently, from all appearances, was a very ordered coffee house.
Yeah, at least from English eyes coming into it, sort of being like, how can we democratize this even further?
classic Republicans.
Yeah.
And so, like, the early coffee houses were quite scandalous from our perception, right? I had this conception of the coffee house as, you know, a nice place to go, you relax, you talk, you possibly, you know, politely debate some topics, and you learn things. It goes hand in hand with the Penny University moniker. You have a chance to learn things and exchange ideas with educated folks for the price of admission, which was oftentimes a penny. Right. At the beginnings, before regulation and before what we think of the coffee house kicks in, because as Helen Berry suggests, right, that is very much partly propaganda and partly a society that becomes influenced by the propaganda to become more polite. Mm-hmm. Right? She says Addison and Steele, through their many publications and periodicals and pamphlets, painted a society they wanted, and then that society molded itself to become that because they thought that's how they should be.
Yeah. I'm thinking about sort of the way that that same idea is worded in another Toronto scholar, Simon Dickey's book, Cruelty and Laughter. He has a beautiful way of describing that sort of rise of a polite culture being a way for this newly prosperous middling sort to at once differentiate themselves from the corrupt aristocracy above them and the sort of lowly, I think he uses the word the mob.
Yes,
beneath them, right?
Yes.
And so going to these penny universities, these coffee houses, becomes a way then to engage in civil discourse and sip on your coffee, but also to kind of perform a kind of class position.
Yeah,
within this very chaotic London. The Penny University is a space, the coffee house is a space where you go to,
be polite.
Perform your position within that complicated social makeup.
With the move away of the aristocracy and the royalty as central in the social life of Britain, and the departure of sort of the church in the same centrality, civility becomes repurposed by the middle class as a way to distinguish themselves.
Yeah.
Right. And it's no longer this thing that you do to mimic the royals. It's this thing you do to be middle class or
decidedly
upper middle class. Yeah. I guess it makes sense that coffee houses were so popular back then, even as they are really popular still today.
Oh,
right?
My God. Yeah. Of course. Huge.
We see like the Starbucks around every corner.
Yep.
But it makes sense back then, too, because they served slightly different. And we can still see some of the same parallel purposes that still have carried on. But we have to think that the 18th century, this period of commercialization, of the rise of the middle class, all of these factors coming together creates a large population with new needs, right? That existing architecture, just speaking practically, doesn't necessarily fulfill, right? Things that we think of as necessary for conducting business today, like a office space, like a mail room, like a place, like a reception area.
Yeah.
All of that didn't exist yet, right? Because these were new businesses that were popping up. Nobody knew how to do them very effectively. And so all of those people made use of the coffee house to do all sorts of different things.
Yeah, to conduct business.
Yes, you could talk business over coffee, and that was seen as a thing to do because coffee, unlike alcohol, sobers you up and makes you better able to think.
Yeah.
Right? You could get your mail delivered to a coffee house and given to you.
I read something about that.
Yeah.
The postal office had a kind of problem with it for a while. They didn't want to do it.
You can imagine why, right?
Why?
You're not giving the letter to the person. You're giving it to a business owner and just trusting that they'll give it.
Yeah, okay. So,
yeah, how do we know, Mary Mall, you're trustworthy with this important letter? Or possibly, what if it contained money? What if I'm sending money?
Yeah.
Why don't you just pocket it? So it takes some time to build up trust, I guess. But also, when you need an office space to write some paperwork down. You don't have an office in your home, which is also your business. You go to the coffee house, get a little cup of coffee, pay a penny, and then you can do your business writing there. And so, it's at once this public space, but a lot of the users were carving out private spaces in there.
Interesting.
Because, and you can still see this today, right? We still have people and I do this myself, bringing my paperwork or, you know, writing to the coffee house, to Starbucks and something, and then writing. As well as there's people who go there to talk to other people.
Yeah. Right?
But when I'm there and I'm working on my writing, I don't think anyone's looking at me. You know, I'm not looking at anyone, so I wouldn't know,
yeah.
But I don't think they're looking at me.
Yeah.
So it's strange that I can have this aura of privacy inside this very public space.
Yeah.
And I go there for that aura of privacy, too.
Yeah.
So they had the exact same thing like that.
A place where you can go. A place where everybody knows your name.
It's not entirely free.
It's not entirely free.
It was very competitively priced, right? Like a penny for entry for most of these, whether, you know, you get to go in and you get that drink, that's affordable for most of the population.
Yeah.
It was designed to be affordable for most of the population.
Yeah. Negligible.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of why it succeeded. So the economics of success for a coffee house is because they were cheap enough to go. They served multi-purpose for business folks. Because one of the other points that we've sort of alluded to and gestured towards and around is that coffee houses were often the biggest subscribers to pamphlets, to
yes.
new literature, to new novels that were coming out even, and just newspapers. Yeah. And so they subscribe to these because they know that, you know, they can have one subscription or two, you know, however large it is, and then just put them on the tables, and then that would be a huge draw. Right,
yeah.
Because, you know, 50 people could read this one subscription that you have, so you make money off of that.
So they really are kind of like a library site almost,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. It was offered most of these people who were, you know, too poor to be a subscriber to these pamphlets and articles and newspapers, but, you know, they have a penny, they can go into these places and learn about the world
yeah.
through news, through, you know, stock information.
And even if they're illiterate, they can walk in and hear other literate coffee house goers talking about it and engage that way.
Yeah.
And so it'd be kind of, yeah.
Yeah. That goes with the social mixing
yeah.
and penny diversity moniker that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
You're drinking a stimulant that boosts brain activity. And this is something weird to think about. And it's not necessarily something that bolsters coffee houses necessarily, but we should also think about coffee houses in terms of how they intertwine not only the public and private spheres, as we talked about,
yeah.
but also the foreign and domestic spheres. Right? So this is
these
before
are sort of goods coming in
yeah.
from
this
yeah.
is it was introduced through the Ottoman Empire,
yep.
Who've had coffee houses there for hundreds of years prior to this point. But one of the reasons why France and Britain were the two largest, within Europe at least, the two largest coffee drinkers is because they both had overseas properties in the Caribbean that could provide coffee house or coffee beans, at least much more cheaply than Germany could or Venice.
That was sort of too what I was always sort of hearing in relation to arguments against Charles II honing in on the coffee houses. This is kind of argument that was presented all the time. It was like, think about all the capital we'll lose without
business.
Yeah. It's good for business, man.
Yeah.
It brings in money. Taxes.
It did. Yeah. Now, obviously, when we say that, we have to remind ourselves that these plantations where these beans are grown weren't the most hospitable, and that's a total euphemism. They were total hellholes, is
yeah.
what I should say. And so there's a cost there, often unseen by the drinkers of the coffee.
The human cost.
Yeah, to their consumption.
Yeah.
But to call back to what you're saying about being sites of information and almost like a library.
Yeah.
And a little factoid here for you. The course of human history was very narrowly altered or prevented from being altered in 1729 because that year, coffee house owners in London petitioned the crown for a monopoly to replace newspapers with coffee house gazettes as the sole source of information and news.
What's a coffee house gazette?
So the abundance of information not only being distributed and read at coffee houses themselves were the sites of news production.
That is absolutely hysterical.
Right? So they have a lot, oftentimes they have a printer in the back just to print, you know, goings-ons of coffee houses.
Printing houses, yeah. Basically.
And like,
that happens so often.
This happens, I mean, this probably started with the more academically leaning coffee houses, right? Where you actually have societies of academics meeting at coffee houses and publishing the proceedings of their meetings through these avenues. But it evolves into, you know, gossip around the town, you know. Just Edison and Steele actually had a little box at a coffee house where members of the public could put in bits of information that they want to see printed in the Gazette or the Spectator.
Interesting.
Or the Tatler.
I'm thinking of the kind of modern equivalent of that. You see these sometimes when you walk into like a diner or just a, you know, a dive bar or something like that, like one of the smaller restaurants. You see those coffee time news things.
Yeah.
They're like little placemats.
Yeah.
That
almost became the norm in some newspapers. Yeah. That would have changed human history.
Do the 18th century jumble and get your horoscope.
It's astounding to think about, right? Because newspapers were the de facto reputable source of information for the longest time until the 20th century. And that could have all been gone and could have been replaced by coffee house sourced news. I think as the 18th century goes on, so the arc that we've covered is they weren't as polite as we think at the beginning. Right? In its beginnings, it was quite rowdy. Prostitutes, you could even buy slaves in a coffee house. And then it, through the influence of Addison and Steele, and this is a common sort of derogatory of the time, but like Whiggish propaganda,
very much
that,
so,
that turns the coffee house into this polite society and civil discourse into the 18th century. And then interestingly, towards the end, I don't know how much reading you've done about how coffee houses sort of fades down towards the end of the 18th century.
I don't know much about the latter half of the century.
Okay, so this is all from James Van Horn Melton's Rise of the Public, but he charts sort of, there is a diminishment, at least from its peak in the 18th century, of coffee houses going into the 19th century. Right?
Okay.
And this really interests me because it places the coffee house as like this prime, emblematic establishment of the 18th century, right?
Yeah.
It comes with the 18th century and it goes with the 18th century. But they evolve over time. They become more fancy. They become equipped with private rooms. And some of them start taking memberships. So you have to be a member to go into the coffee house. And these could become pretty expensive. Tom's.
You get a rewards card?
Yeah. A little early for that, but basically the same idea.
Stuff, yeah.
Tom's in 1764 had 700 members.
Oh, wow.
So these were quite large, but membership could cost, you know, 6 shillings or £6 or something a year, which becomes unaffordable for the former penny university goers.
And so that sort of makes it into more exclusive clubs than the clientele that you're getting.
Yep.
Interesting.
White's had a 6p admission, which is 6 times the going rate. But hilariously, that failed to do what they wanted it to do, which is keep out, you know, the riffraff. That failed. And so the wealthier frequenters, the wealthier patrons, just bought the place and just became their own private coffee house instead, which I always thought was hilarious. So then there's like this dissolution of coffee houses in the 19th century, partly because of these trends.
Mm.
You have propriety starting to take over, you know, what we think of as perhaps silly pamphlet, the Women's Petition, which alleges, you know, you're gossiping too much and you're away from the home too much. That starts to become legitimate causes for concern going into the 19th century, the sort of 19th century sense of propriety and the place of the man in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a greater distinction towards into the 19th century between what is public and what is private.
Yeah.
Right. And if, you know, as the empire grows, and as the influence of England grows, and as the influx of these formerly slightly exotic goods becomes much more commonplace, you can have coffee in your house, right? You don't have to go to the coffee house anymore. And if you're starting to be wealthy, if more people are literate, you don't have to go to a coffee house for news either. But I think that just about concludes it for...
That's fun.
Yeah. Do you have anything else you want to bring up?
I'll see you next time. I'll be back.
We'll be back.
We'll be back to talk about... We decided on a topic for our next session. We have a list.
I have no idea. This is...
We decided an order yet.
We do have a list. We do have a list.
Yeah. But yeah, thanks for listening very much.
Thanks for joining us on this model of coffee house discourse we just enacted for you.
Oh, we forgot to mention that.
That's okay. That wasn't never going to be a draw.